son, his, Smith, Dad. Don't be late. That's why I can hardly wait. Open up your golden gate, California. Here I come.
Now, nothing like a scratchy banjo and a counter tenor. We learned last week that the Seattle facility of the National Archives, a fixture in the Sandpoint neighborhood, since 1963, may be sold and the entire contents shipped to Riverside, California. And our resident activist historian, Felix Bunnell, is having none of it. And apparently he's trying to keep it here. Felix is sponsored by the King County Library System, and you now have some significant developments can report to us?
It's been a busy week. As a quick refresher, this facility sits on 10 acres across from Magnuson Park, Old Navy Warehouse built in the 40s, converted to the archives in 63. It holds millions of documents, photos, and maps, federal records for Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska going back to the 1840s. It's not an overstatement to say these are foundational documents, the administrative DNA from when the native ground we stand upon officially became part of the United States. Now, the research room there is open to the public, used by professionals and amateur historians, students, legal researchers, genealogists, and Native Americans to access priceless historical records. Now, thanks to a Cairo listener, we learned last week that it's on a list of a dozen federally owned high-value assets. The government wants to sell these in a big, fat hurry as part of a law that Congress passed in 2016 and that was signed by President Obama. The Office of Management and Budget, these are the same OMB folks involved in the Ukraine scandal.
Mm-hmm.
They will decide by this Sunday, January 26, if those properties will be rapidly sold and the archive materials will be moved to California and Missouri. Now, I had two reactions to this. One is I don't want these materials to leave Seattle, perhaps because I'm irrationally possessive. I will own that. But two, regardless of how anyone feels about the historical stuff, the utter lack of public process for a building that we all own just feels wrong. Say it with me. Keep your government hands off my National Archives. Anyway, since we aired the story on Friday, I heard from a lot of people in the history community around Washington and Oregon. I also heard from a historian in Alaska named Penelope Goforth.
There should have been more of a public process here. And, I guess sort of in their defense, when you talk about public asset reform, people just go to sleep. I mean, these multi-syllable words hardly mean anything anymore on a daily basis. But this turned out to be really horrendous.
Penelope's led an effort in Alaska, and she's mobilized a bunch of lot of organizations and elected officials. Alaskans feel twice burned because the Anchorage National Archives was shut down back in 2014, and they said, "Don't worry, we're just moving everything to Seattle, where you can access it pretty easily." So they are literally feeling sort of twice burned. Now, I've spent the past several days pestering Representative Pramila Jayapal, Mayor Jenny Durkin, and Seattle City Councilmember Alex Peterson. I couldn't get anyone to actually talk to me, but I did get some written statements, which I think are worth sharing some highlights from. And I'll quote here. This is what Representative Jayapal said: "I'm deeply troubled that the Public Buildings Reform Board." This is the agency that's actually put the list of properties together, the PBRB. They neglected to brief state and local elected officials or engage the local public on their proposal to sell the National Archives facility in Sandpoint. When the PBRB contacted my office, they notified my staff that they intended to conduct outreach to state and local officials and stakeholders. Critical input when the federal government is proposing to close facilities that serve the public. I urge OMB to withhold approval of the PBRB's recommendations until it consults with state and local officials and engages the public. Those are pretty strong words. I also traded emails with Kamaria Hightower, a spokesperson for Mayor Jenny Durkin, and this is what she said. "Unfortunately, this move by the Office of Management and Budget has..." I got to practice saying budget more clearly.
Yes.
"This move by the OMB has had limited input from our community, stakeholders, and the tribes, and comes as a surprise to leaders not only in our state, but also Alaska, Idaho, and Oregon. Mayor Durkin has had discussions with members of the federal delegation about this issue." So she's reached out to Cantwell's and Murray's staff. In addition, I think she might have been in touch with Jayapal as well. So that's intriguing. That might be the only way to stop this, is if the federal delegation gets involved. I spoke to with a staffer from the office of one of our senators last night, and they're understandably otherwise occupied with the impeachment trial. I also heard from City Councilmember Alex Peterson, whose district includes the National Archives. He said he's been contacting community leaders and the Public Buildings Reform Board. Now, that agency last week offered him a briefing, but it would have been in February after the January 26th deadline, which didn't make much sense. He's trying to get one scheduled sooner. And he also said this, quote, "I told the PBRB I'm concerned about what appears to be a lack of public engagement for the proposed sale of the property. As I understand it, the law, which is the basis for the proposed sale, requires public engagement as well as local public hearings sponsored by the federal agency. My team will continue to follow this issue closely and bring much needed accountability, transparency, and public discourse to this process." I'm glad that quote didn't have the word budget in it, because I would have stumbled over it again. All right. And last but not least, should the OMB decision go forward, I reached out to the office of Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson to ask if he would consider a lawsuit. Because, you know, he sued everybody else.
Sure,
why not?
Sure.
And his communications director said in an email, as Attorney General Ferguson always says, he has three criteria he looks at before he files a lawsuit. Are Washingtonians being harmed? Do we have standing to bring a lawsuit? And do we have good legal arguments? I can't get more specific at this time. So it all comes
down
to
this. Sounds like a no to me.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It comes down to this decision being made on or before this Sunday, January 26th. And the this PBRB, this group that's doing it, they're going to post the decision on their website as soon as it's available. I'm going to keep hitting refresh. Starting at midnight Saturday, I'm going to keep hitting refresh on my browser to see
You got to fill the streets with angry historians is what you got to do.
Well, historians don't get angry, Dave. We just take action. And we send emails and we put petitions together and we reach out to our elected officials who have the power in this. So one thing with this, it might have been the National Archives' idea to shut this facility down. They might have offered it up. It's unclear. They won't talk to me at all. Yeah. So it's not like the Fed said, you know, the higher up said, shut this thing down. It might have been offered up as something they were planning to do anyway.
They say it's time to subpoena some documents before those documents get moved to California.
Good luck with that.
Thank you, Felix.
Thanks.
Figuring out how to cope with your job, your family, your financial obligations, and medical appointments can be an overwhelming experience for people who are living with cancer. ChiRadio's Mealy Katie tells us about a group that aims to help.
The Northwest Sarcoma Foundation provides hope, education, and critical financial support to patients battling a rare form of cancer. Executive Director Lisa Edwards says the typical patient going through sarcoma faces between $100,000 and $200,000 of debt.
It is not unusual for patients to not only lose their job, but to also have to sell off their belongings and their home to try and cover medical costs.
She says she's seen firsthand how the disease can cripple someone's life and how the right kind of support can give them hope.
It's the 18-year-old who was accepted to the Air Force Academy and planned to be a pilot who has his arm amputated and has to completely change his career plan and trajectory and is now planning to be a teacher.
The nonprofit offers life-changing grants to both adults and children who've been diagnosed. They also provide community resources to ensure no one faces cancer alone.
It's not just cutting a check. It's becoming a supporter, advocate, and friend for every patient.
That's why Bonneville Seattle is proud to partner with the Seattle Seahawks and Carter Subaru, Volkswagen, and now Acura in honoring Northwest Sarcoma Foundation as our charity of the month. Find out more at mynorthwest.com.
Kara's Miley Katie. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us, District 3 Seattle City Councilwoman Shama Sawant. And, of course, the big question is the new Amazon tax you've proposed. And I think you're on record as saying it's not personal, but the amount to be collected has gone up from, I think, $47 million, which was your original head tax proposal, the one that the council finally took back. It's now gone up to $200 million. So what would the money be for?
Well, as we know, the city of Seattle and also the surrounding region is in the throes of an unprecedented affordable housing shortage and homelessness crisis, which is the worst per capita of any city around the nation. In 2018, unfortunately, many of the centrist politicians and some of the movement leaders, they decided, you know what, the only way to do this is not to oppose big business, but to bring them to the table, bring them along, and so on and so forth. And so that original number of over $200 got watered down over and over and over over again, ultimately coming down to $47 million. And then less than a month later, they went and filed a referendum to undermine the city council's vote, which is why the city council ended up repealing it. So our starting point has to be, what does our city need? The regional task force of homelessness for King County has said that at a very conservative estimate, in order to address the affordability needs of today, which means homelessness plus people who are paying too much in rent, and chances are, if you're listening to this, you're paying too much in rent, then we need at least $400 million a year. So in reality, we should be demanding $400 to $500 million, and I think right now the movement is saying $200 to $300 million, but I think that is proceeding from the needs of the city.
Now, do you know what form this tax will take?
what we're proposing as a Tax Amazon 2020 campaign is a two-pronged strategy. You know, so I will be bringing a legislation soon, hopefully in a few weeks or at least in the next couple of months, for discussion on the council. But we cannot let the movement be stymied if the council doesn't vote yes on a big business tax. We need the option of a ballot initiative as well. So in order to have maximum input for ordinary people, we launched the Tax Amazon rally on the 13th, which, as you know, was a thundering support rally for the idea of taxing big business to fund housing. But we're going to follow that up with what we're calling the Tax Amazon Action Conference on Saturday, January 25th at 10 a.m. at Washington Hall in the Central District. And I urge everybody who's listening to this, if you care about having an affordable city, if you're paying too much of your income in rent and you're one rent increase away from being priced out of the city, then you should join us. Whatever choices we make in my legislation and in the ballot initiative will be based on the community input we get on the 25th.
But is that what you're promising your supporters, that if they support you in this fight for an unspecified type of tax, their rent will go down?
I'm not promising them anything, something that's pie in the sky. What I'm letting them know is that if we have a substantial public revenue from progressive sources like taxing Amazon and other big businesses, then it will allow us to have the funds available to carry out a major expansion in social housing, which is publicly owned, permanently affordable apartments and housing, not only for those who are facing homelessness, but regular working people who may not be homeless, but who might be hurting when they pay their rent, and which I can guarantee you are most of your listeners. The false promise that I refuse to make, which many politicians end up making, is this peddling, this, you know, snake oil that just let the market build, and then one day, magically, the rents will come down. Such a thing has never happened, and I speak as an economist. For making housing affordable, we need publicly owned social housing. The only solution, and the one solution that does work against cutting funding, is to not cut funding. In other words, having a steady stream of public revenues to make sure that not only new social housing is built, but existing social housing is maintained. That is the plan that we have.
And that would be paid by big business. And big business will sit still and just pay that without responding to it in any way, either by moving their operations, let's say, to Bellevue or suspending them altogether?
Well, first of all, just on your earlier question about, you know, how can we make sure that social housing is well maintained? Well, make sure that there's a steady stream of revenues that creates not only construction jobs, but also maintenance and operations jobs, which is the plan we are putting forward, which is for construction, operations, and maintenance jobs to be created so that people also have unionized living wage job opportunities. And for this reason, one thing that's important is in the ballot initiative and in the ordinance for the Amazon tax, we say no to any sunset clause. We do not want an end to the revenues because that's what will gut.
So this would be a perpetual tax then. Once it's passed, you would not put it like, not a 7-year period.
There has been a perpetual, disproportionate, and criminally unequal tax burden on ordinary people, on working people, on the poor, on small businesses. So what we are talking about is a very small measure of justice in a very unjust system called capitalism. So let me be crystal clear. The reason we are calling it the Amazon tax is to make it very clear to people this is a tax on big corporations, not on small businesses, not on the workers or the employees of the corporations, and not on working people or homeowners or renters as a whole. Now, you asked the question about, you know, will big business move its operations? Look, you know, when big business makes those threats, we don't take them lightly because under capitalism, big corporations and billionaires have disproportionate clout and power and wealth to do things that we don't have the power to do. So we don't take those threats lightly. But throughout history, including the $15 minimum wage example in Seattle, we have seen that the only response you can have to this kind of bullying and threats and extortions by billionaires like Jeff Bezos is not to back down. The only way to deal with bullies is to stand up, unite, and fight back. And New York City has shown them. New York City, Jeff Bezos wanted a $3 billion giveaway. The working people of New York, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, many other movement leaders said, hell no, we're not giving the richest man in the world $3 billion. There's no way that's happening. And they forced Amazon to take a defeat. And then Amazon set up the jobs anyway. When workers win a victory anywhere, it inspires workers everywhere. And in fact, that is exactly what the billionaires are afraid of. They are afraid. They are angry. They are so livid. You know, people often ask me, why are these billionaires so angry? We're just asking for a small modicum of justice. Why would they deny us this? The reason they deny you is not only because they are loath to part with even one penny of all the exploited money that they have with them. It's also because of the example it sets. You know, they don't want the contagion of working class confidence to spread from one city to another. But that is exactly what I want. That is what exactly our movement wants. Yeah. We want victories to spread from one city to another.
Representing District 3 on the Seattle City Council, Shama Sawan. Councilmember Sawan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dave.
It was part of a much longer interview where she also talked about unionizing Amazon workers. And we talked about, well, those are the two things that Jeff Bezos really hates, another tax and a union. But she stands firm and she says that's what she's going for.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. It's so funny, Dave. I reacted to your commentary because you mentioned the protesters down in Richmond, Virginia, or the ralliers. Yeah. I don't think they were protesting necessarily. Picked up their own trash. That's exactly what my dose of kindness is about.
Really?
This morning is, yeah, because I think, you know, not every headline about the gun rights and gun control fight has to be controversial. Sometimes good things happen, even in tense moments. And so I found the report from WRIC reporter who was there when people were like, wow, these streets look cleaner than they did before the rally. So here's his report on that.
People from the area say this is the cleanest they've seen these roads and sidewalks. Activists saying they made sure to clean up because
it represents the group and the movement very poorly if we leave a lot of trash behind.
So Matthew Kiesling and others took it upon themselves to pick up anything left on the ground, from stickers to signs.
I've been in the area when there have been other protests and demonstrations and people leave a lot of trash behind, and it waters down the message.
And the cameras caught these demonstrators using their pocket knives. You know, they all armed themselves to the teeth.
Right.
And they used some of those weapons, like a knife, to scrape gum off the streets and pick stickers off the sidewalks, rounding it all up in trash and garbage cans. So just wanted to highlight that light moment in what can be a very tense debate.
And they shall turn their pocket knives into gum scrapers. And the lion shall lie down with the lamb. Time for our sports insider, Stacy Ross from Tom, Jake, and Stacy, weekdays at noon on 710 ESPN Seattle. Stacy, the NFL has long had a serious problem, and that is that between February and August, there's no way to keep football top of mind every single day. So they have to figure out something to do, and the draft comes in handy because it happens in April. And this year, Chris was explaining to me what they've done with Las Vegas, but essentially they're going to take it over.
Yeah. So the best part about this entire thing is specifically how they're going to announce the picks and then bring the picks to the stage. So this draft stage is going to be a floating stage on the water at the Fountains of Bellagio, and draft picks are going to go to the stage by boat.
When I saw this, I said, how big is that? I've never been there. So I was thinking International Fountain, Seattle Center. No, this is more like Lake Washington. So
I mean, it's big, but the boat is sort of like a little mini water taxi, though.
Yeah.
It strikes me that this will just drag out the whole presentation.
Well, that's the idea, isn't it?
You want to watch that?
Well, no, I don't, but a lot of people do because they've got money on it, don't they?
Well, I mean, there's money on the draft, but I mean, also, it's just this huge, huge event. I think we looked up ratings I think last year there were 11 million people who tuned in for the first night of the draft. So for instance, for a Monday night football game, there's about 12 million people. So you have about as many people as would watch a primetime football game tuning in for the first night of the draft.
That's
but
amazing.
The best part about all of this, I know, it's wild. And they're having like a red carpet. It's just become this event in itself. It's not just the draft. It's an entire takeover of everything.
Isn't it the stories, though? I mean, I feel like people tune in for those phone calls where they are changing the lives of these young men, not to see them, you know, catamaran to a stage by boat.
That's true. The boat thing is, I'm waiting to see. There have to be bets being placed right now to see who's the first player to either fall in or just swim over, right? There's no way those bets are being placed.
So the potential is there.
And they're shutting down the strip, too, for that weekend, it sounds like.
Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, it doesn't surprise me because you have to have everyone available. So you have to have all of the potential first-round picks there, all of their families. Then you've got all of the fans that are watching. I mean, it is...
Wait, so
it is
all
a spectator
of
event.
all the potential picks go there. What about the ones who don't get picked? Doesn't that become embarrassing if you're right out there waiting?
It's all of the potential kind of, if you get a an invite to go, you're an early round pick. So maybe you'll be picked in the second round or first round, but it's not all of the eligible picks, but there are certainly famous stories of players who wait a really long time. Johnny Manziel being a recent one, he still went in the first round, but it was like every other pick, the camera was trained on him because he was, you know, expected to go maybe even first overall, maybe a top five, and he slid all the way near the bottom of the first round, and the camera was just looking at him every time. Same with Aaron Rodgers.
So embarrassing. It's like losing the Academy Award. They focus the camera on you and see your reaction.
Exactly. And it's like, hey, look very graceful.
So what? How does, maybe you can explain this to me. Are you a betting person, by the way?
No, I'm not.
What do you bet on? You bet on which round a certain guy is picked in? Stuff
I'm
like
sure
that?
There are bets like that.
Oh, yeah.
They probably have.
I mean, is it official?
First,
I mean,
overall.
I know people sitting at home do prop bets, but I mean, there are official odds makers for basically everything.
Yeah,
definitely.
And prop bets, too, that include, like Stacey mentioned, who, you know, over under on how many guys go in the water, you know, stupid things like that. I mean, and you're doing it in Sin City, where I was over the weekend. Yeah, it's anything goes on that weekend.
Huh. Yeah, the color of the tux or the color of the suit of the first person drafted, things like that.
I'll stick with the stock market. At least there you only lose like 10-20%, not everything.
Dave, although, now I want you to watch the draft and then give a total review of it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do my best, but right now I'm sort of preoccupied with impeachment, but you know, I'll give it a try. Our sports insider, Stacey Ross. Thank you, Stacey.
Thanks, guys.
Every U.S. senator had a 12-plus hour work day yesterday, and they're making their way back to the Senate chambers right now to start up again. Of course, this is the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. Gets underway in earnest today. Let's go live to CBS News White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Did any of the 12 hours of arguing yesterday end up changing any of the rules, Stephen?
No, not any of the rules that Mitch McConnell put up yesterday. What he did do was he changed some of the rules, and that was a change from what he announced the day before. And forgive me if you have no idea what I'm talking about or you get confused by this, I will understand it. But long story short, the Democrats tried 11 different times to amend this resolution put forward by Mitch McConnell, and in each case, the Senate majority swatted down the attempt tabling these motions to require, for example, that the president's senior staff be subpoenaed, people like Mick Mulvaney and other officials at the Office of Management and Budget and the Pentagon. In each case, for the most part, along party lines, the Senate voted to dispatch with these proposals. So what we have is overnight the passage of the organizing resolution that will today, in about 2 hours, begin this trial in earnest. And even though yesterday we got a significant preview, an in-depth preview from the House managers, today they'll begin their opening argument, their presentation of the case to the Senate. And they'll have up to 3 days to deliver this argument to the senators, to the American people, without any immediate response from the president's attorneys. And essentially, they'll have 24 uninterrupted hours to make their case.
Okay, so I mean, that was the main change. They're going to do it in two, and then they allow them to expand it to three. But the president is saying now that he would like to attend the trial. This is the clip.
I'd love to go. Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be beautiful? I don't know. I'd sort of love to sit right in the front row and stare at their corrupt faces. I'd love to do it.
Okay, so, I mean, probably joking. But he also said that he'd be happy if John Bolton testified. Is there going to be any opportunity to do anything approaching that, to bring in John Bolton, to even allow the president to sit in the Senate if he wants to, or to bring in more documents, or is that all going to be voted down by the Republican majority?
Well, the president could attend the sessions of the impeachment trial if he wanted to. He's been summoned to appear. And he's chosen to have his lawyers represent him. Mm-hmm. He, as you heard, said at a news conference today in Davos, Switzerland, that he would love to attend and as he put it, stare at those corrupt faces. But it's not clear if he was joking or not. Look, and when it comes to whether he'll allow his most senior aides to testify, current and or former, he strongly suggested that he will not allow for it. He talked about national security concerns. He talked about the idea of executive privilege, which is a very interesting question and ultimately poses a novel constitutional question, because I'm not sure there's ever been a circumstance in an impeachment trial where, and I don't think this was the case in 1868, and it certainly wasn't the case in 1999, where the president tried to prevent testimony and say, you know, you can't hear from X, Y, and Z official because I say so,
yeah.
Right? That's what it essentially boils down to. He believes he has particular interests to protect on behalf of the executive, and they include, which he's naming them, he's talking about national security concerns. He's afraid that former national security advisor John Bolton might say something classified to the public.
Really?
Right? And that's what he says. And he therefore, for that reason, no testimony at all, right? Not even in private. Then he says the acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, already did an extensive television interview on Fox. And therefore, yeah, he said enough, and he need not be heard from in the Senate.
Okay, I've got one more question, Stephen. It'll have to be kind of a short answer, but Adam Schiff raised the concern that if the president gets off, this means every future president can just say, sorry, not cooperating, you know, too bad. Is that true? Do impeachment trials set a precedent such that if the president gets his way, as you describe, then other future presidents basically have free reign to do whatever they want as long as their party is in power in the Senate?
All you have to do is listen to the argument one of the president's lawyers is making. And, you know, what they're saying is, in 1868, the Senate acquitted by a single vote Andrew Johnson, right? Mm-hmm. And the argument was that he didn't commit a crime. Alan Dershowitz is saying that is the precedent that should apply here, because the Senate didn't convict a president in 1868 for violating the Tenure of Office Act, which essentially most Republicans would argue today is unconstitutional because it infringes upon the president's appointment power. That therefore, because the Senate didn't take an action then, that therefore the precedent stands and can't be invoked or can't be violated now. And so, yes, in some respect, you may have be onto something, Dave, and that is the idea that if the president is acquitted in this case, maybe there is no accountability for a president who commits the same kind of alleged offenses that Democrats say this president has committed. And that's why they are raising this alarm and saying this is the moment to act. But the president insists he did nothing wrong and that it's the House that's abused its power under the Constitution.
CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Stephen, thanks.
You bet.
Overflow crowds in Olympia,
when lawmakers took up a series of new gun proposals, and Hannah Scott is here with a look at some of the big-ticket items and if they have a chance of passing. So what is the big legislation?
Big-ticket items that we're talking about this session are once again, limits on so-called high-capacity magazines. Once again, that's no more than 10 rounds per magazine. And then the so-called assault weapons ban that was requested by both the state attorney general and the governor this time around, which was a new request. There was there's in the House and Senate, there are proposals for the high capacity magazines. Just in the House is where the assault weapons ban is. Both days we had the Senate was up first on Monday and then the House on yesterday. Really big crowds on both sides of the issue. People really some emotional and passionate testimony we heard yesterday from people who'd lost loved ones in places like the Las Vegas concert shooting, as well as Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooting.
Large capacity magazines make it simpler and faster to fire more rounds at a target. When shooters use them, more people are injured and more people are killed.
Carmen was fatally shot 4 times through the door of her classroom. The shooter's high capacity magazines meant that he didn't have to stop for a few seconds to reload. Seconds that it could have meant the difference between life and death.
Please remember that when the shooting starts, for some of us, the loss is forever.
And those both in both of those shooting, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas and then the Las Vegas shooting, of course, they talked about the assault weapons being used and the ability to fire without having to stop and reload with the high capacity magazines. But there was just as much pushback on both of those proposals from those on the gun rights side. And they were there in force as well.
Standard capacity magazines over 10 rounds do not make a gun shoot faster. Do not change it into an automatic.
As a resident of this state, I find it shocking the lengths that are being taken to ensure law-abiding citizens are stripped of their right to bear arms.
Assault weapons and magazines are going to ultimately be settled by the court. Why don't you just wait until we have settled law rather than create panic buying that will actually bring more magazines into the state?
I heard
that has happened in the past, right? Whenever they talk about limiting magazines, suddenly they fly off the shelves.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, he said that last year. He said he went out and bought a I can't remember if it was a 30 or 100 round magazine, yeah, just because he knew it wasn't he wasn't going to be able to. And that absolutely happens whenever you're talking about any kind of a gun prohibition, regardless of what kind it might be, whatever it is you're talking about, you see people go out and stock up on those.
On the gun control side, do they ever address this idea that for the sake of stopping these mass shootings, which I mean are horrible, but relatively rare.
Rare.
You then you upset the daily habits of a lot of people who never misuse guns.
I don't hear the gun control people saying anything other than this is common sense, sensible gun control.
So they don't feel these things have any impact on law-abiding gun owners.
No, this is their sensible gun control measures. And they, you'll hear from the gun control side, the gun safety side, high-capacity magazines and assault weapons are made for one thing, to kill people. Yeah. Those who use them argue absolutely not. They're for sport. Or in the case of high-capacity magazines, as they're defined here, we're talking about more than 10 rounds. A large number of guns have magazines that contain more than 10 rounds, handguns, and those that are most popular. So that's what you're going to hear from the NRA and from a lot of gun owners, as a matter of fact. So
where do you stop on either side? So if 10 rounds makes them safer, then limiting it to 5 rounds would make them safer yet, and then limiting every gun to one shot would make them super safe. I mean, you know, how far does it go?
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you know, if 10 isn't too big, then 50 isn't too big, then maybe 2,000 rounds isn't too big. Of course, that makes a gun pretty heavy. But
yeah, and I think should be the 10 rounds. I think that a lot of handgun magazines go up to 17 rounds, I believe, in their magazines. So maybe you limit at 20 or something like that rather than include all these. I think the idea here is that there are other states that have passed laws that limit to more than 10 magazines.
In those states, are there fewer shootings?
I don't believe so. In fact, there was somebody who put out a statistic yesterday that showed, and I cannot recall the state off the top of my head, possibly California, that shootings went up after they had this. They had passed that particular law. So other things that were brought up that were interesting in this debate yesterday, it was House Republican Representative Jenny Graham on multiple occasions asked questions, even to someone who had lost a family member in a shooting, about wouldn't it be more prudent to deal with lock people up when they've committed other crimes, go after things, you know what I mean? That was a big part of the discussion.
Go after the people who we know are going to abuse the weapons.
Absolutely.
Well, and, but I hear that we've done that with red flag laws, right?
to some degree, and that's still a fairly new thing. But yeah, he's definitely to some degree, and that particular law looks at getting to something before there's actually a crime committed. But yeah, so she didn't get very far on that particular thing. As far as the chances of this getting passed this session, let's talk about this. So Democratic House Majority Leader Lori Jenkins said yesterday, first of all, and I didn't know this until yesterday, this is something that would go as far as the assault weapons ban proposal. Mm-hmm. It would take a big vote to get this passed.
It will likely require a two-thirds vote because, I mean, I haven't seen the legal analysis, but I think it does amend Initiative 1639.
So because it amends something that was passed by the voters, it has to go a certain amount of time where you got to have the two-thirds vote. As far as getting the so-called assault weapons ban passed, she has not, they haven't caucused on it yet. She says we'll have to see what comes out of committee, if it comes out of committee. But even then,
I have more hope of high cap magazines than I do the assault weapons ban for a lot of reasons. But we have not, again, we haven't briefed it or discussed it in caucus. Mm-hmm. So first thing is seeing if it moves out of committee, moving it out of committee.
So
and did they present data showing that either of those two things would reduce the number of shootings?
No. No. Okay. It's just something that, you know.
So it sounds like we are where we were. That's the way I'm feeling.
And
now.
Yeah, my sense is that there is a little bit more momentum on the, like Laura Jenkins just said, the limits on high capacity magazines. Mm-hmm. I think there's three bills floating around that actually address that same thing.
Well, I know, but that would be a victory, a political victory. But if it doesn't change what's happening out there, then what have you achieved?
What have you accomplished? So we wait and see. Certainly, the people that are behind these believe that this would save some lives. I think there's varying statistics on whether or not it would, but the overall selling point tends to be that those are just used to kill more people. And there are those rare instances like mass shootings when they've literally taken out so many people because there wasn't that few seconds to stop and make that person reload and give the opportunity to tackle them or something like that. It's a legit argument, but it's a small, rare number of cases, and we'll have to see how it goes. I do want to point one other thing out. There's a series of other bills. The gun background checks on ammo also came up yesterday. That's the thing where you have to wait and have the federal background check even allowed. But also state preemption came up. There's a bill to undo state preemption that was amended during this hearing.
So that you have different rules on the eastern side of the state as opposed to the western side of the state.
Yes, and it sounds to me like that was watered down to now allow state preemption to continue, but have some more gun-free zones like parks and libraries.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.